you do have a higher body, up or down the side.
Okay. Steve Reich Sextet, can't wait for a cadence to cut it off because there won't be one. There is no stopping point in most of Steve Reich's minimalist music. It's not about phrasing and shape and structure and form. It's about an energy level. It's about a kind of pulse and rhythm and clarity and insistence and brevity and efficiency and intensity of tone quality and intensity of mental concentration, which characterizes our modern age, which is why it is and has been, at least starting in the 70s, the music of today, as opposed to, or at least one music of today, as opposed to Schubert and Brahms and the music that we like to think about in the Western canon. I'm Carol Reynolds. I'm very honored to be here and to meet you today. And I'd like to have started with that, because whether we're looking at the minimalist music, or we're looking at the architecture, or the fashion, or the design, or the structures in which we often meet, not this gorgeous Francis Marion Hotel from 1924, but the other structures we might be meeting in, if we were meeting in a very brand new whatever hotel, or convention centers being the best, you know, where there is this austerity and efficiency and insistence on clarity and sharpness and edge and function and the multitasking of what you were hearing in the Steve Reich, we would be fully engulfed in that environment. In the bottom line in education with the fine arts, I think, and I have a feeling I'm preaching already to the choir, which is the best kind of thing, is that we already know that the fine arts provide the hub of understanding of any historical era. I like to say analyze the historical records through the lens of the arts. Analyze the historical record through the lens of the arts. It doesn't take anything for a child to do that, even if they don't have the vocabulary or any training. But when you analyze the historical record through the lens of the arts, certain things happen: clarity, vividness, memorability, retainability, excitement. And really, I could just stop right there, and that's all we need to do, and then we'll all go out and get some fajitas or something, you know, which is what we eat a lot of down where I'm from in Texas. As a child of the 50s, I think I was taught a good deal of in Roanoke, Virginia. I think I got something of a classical education, of course did not know it, and because it was normal to start Latin even in Roanoke, Virginia in seventh grade, and we got the great books and we had amazing teachers and we sang our folk songs and did our folk dance and did our drawings and had this kind of wonderful thing that was, considering my school and our neighborhood, sort of astonishing to me to this day. When I look back at those ladies, Miss Clark and Miss Shelton, and what we did and the rigor and the physical education and the way it was all integrated, and of course we were kids, and did we care? Of course not. Kids don't care, but boy, they cared. And I am grateful for that, for starters. And I'm also very grateful that the fine arts elements were so integrated that we didn't know it. No, we didn't have this and we didn't have that. We had a couple of books and occasionally a film strip, which blew us away, you know, blew us away. And was memorable and vivid and retainable. And we actually, okay. But all of that seems rather quaint now, except not really. That structure of putting and weaving things together is the mantra of the arts within education. And fortunately, the neurologists have come around to it in recent time. Maybe some of you know Daniel Pink's book, A Whole New Mind, where he talks about how right-brainers are the future, and we have left the industrial age, and the information age has moved offshore, and we're looking now at the conceptual age. And the conceptual age will require the right brain qualities that they can now actually, you know, put those little things on. I mean, I don't know if it has to go, where is it, which side, wherever it is. They now know, you know, they can prove that when you listen to something or paint or draw, things go on that didn't go on otherwise. So this is really helpful for everybody, from the music therapist, the art therapist. This entire field that's developing, SMU, where I taught for years, is huge into a music therapy degree, and it's just wonderful. Those people get jobs, which is nice in the arts too, you know. You know, it's a whole new mind and a whole new world and a whole new way of looking at training. So this is all something that is totally exciting to see the sciences and the business world begin to acknowledge what people have known for millennia about the value of training the artistic sensibilities. And again, now we can stop there and we're done. Two. But I'll go through some of the steps that have come to mean something to me, and I suspect to you as well, and hope that it will be useful, or at least reinforcing, or we can see where we add to it and disagree with it, etc. But Steve Reich is a good starting place. If it were 1820, we would be thinking something quite different as the soundscape of our world. You could think about primary questions. We're here officially. Now that wasn't very nice, was it? This would be a funny time for it completely to crash. But it would serve me right, wouldn't it? That's really...
Did your computer go to sleep?
I don't know. It shouldn't have. I don't let much of anything go to sleep. Isn't it... Well, I think it's coming back.
Power cord.
Now, it is such a detail, but I think I'm out of power. So, I didn't bring it. That's pretty funny in its own way, but it is in the room. So my apologies. It would be useful, of course, but I think I know what the topics are, so that's very good. We'll catch up later with the visual quantities. You do? You have an apple? This just proves that no matter how much you lay it out, my poor husband is going to go and get that, like so many good spouses do. And, oh no, you've got the newer one. He is younger, and does it work?
Uh-huh,
will it? Oh, I thought it was turned a different way. So we're still back to the old film strip where Mrs. Shelton couldn't get it to work, right? And the slide projector, we do the slide projector that, of course, powwow. Thank you. I give up. Well, on. Sir, is there another plug? Is it? Let's find out. Oh, there is. There is. You see, this is why I do not fly airplanes, and that's important to know. In fact, I try to keep most of my activities to non-life endangering things. And it's important to know your strengths and your weaknesses. And I also do not generally conduct, because you can cause other kinds of train wrecks with an ensemble when you suddenly go, oh, I should have thought of turning the car off in the garage, when in fact you've just brought the tenors in now, you know, way too early. So as I say, I try to stay in that safe spot. All right, well, it will do something. That's that happy sound. That wouldn't have been a known. Now, we talk about soundscapes. I like to sometimes with students think about the sounds we have. You could get them to make a list. Well, they can't do it. You can do it for them. That would have never existed until, what, the last 20 years? The cappuccino machine. There's a good one. Plus, sometimes it's very fun to present them with sounds from the past, like the old gas stations, you know, with the tanks where it would go, ring, and another half gallon would go in, ring, and they have no idea what that is, of course. You can think of 50 sounds right off that one no longer hears that define history. So that goes back to analyzing the historical record, if you wish, through the arts, which clearly includes soundscape. In a minute or an hour or so, we'll have this back up. Look, it's cooperating beautifully. You get to see my messy desktop. This is, of course, what you wish not to happen, but all right. Back to where we were. I'm sort of convinced that this may be how movements get dropped out of entire symphonies, when the poor composer never quite got around to writing that movement. That was, all right. All right. Oh, let's see. We could sing a hymn. We have that. And it's coming. There's the beach ball of death. Is that what you all call it? Someone offered me a chord. And you were so kind. Was he kind to go get that? That's very, very, very. Thank you. Thank you. Have a seat, Hank, and that's my husband, Hank, who gets us normally where we're going. Where were we? We were at primary questions. You already know these. Okay? We can think of that as background. Both how do the fine arts help the task of a classical education, and how will having a classical education, however it comes out with your children, promote their discernment and acceptance and understanding of the fine arts. So if we're going to really do this, we have to play school and we have to decide what the fine arts are. There's a nice sweet term. It's off-putting to a lot of people, the fine arts. You know, what does that mean, of course? But it actually has a rather good historical basis. It comes out in the mid-18th century. One of the earliest uses of les beaux-arts, the fine arts, is from Charles Batteau, who was an interesting educator, aesthetician, philosopher, whatever, and he came up with this in 1746, and then went on to write two or three more treatises talking about this new construct that would have puzzled somebody in 1300 or 1700, even though they had all the arts, but the construct of the fine arts. And basically, down in a nutshell, he said the things that we use as the basis of a lot of our aesthetics today, which is, where does art come from? It's free imitation of nature, the best art, the fine art, the beautiful art. Free imitation of nature. And that there are the mechanical arts, tremendously important, whose goal is utility, whose purpose is utility, without which we don't have, you know, we don't have decent horseshoes, and we don't have decent, you know, chandeliers and wiring and beautiful windows. We don't have craft. We don't have many, many things. And then there is the fine, what he would call ultimately the fine arts. The end of that goal, of that endeavor, is beauty. Beauty. Which is the basis of, you know, so many aspects of aesthetics in Western culture. A word that we're funny about today because we've gotten far away from what beauty means. Ask your kids what beauty means. They won't come anywhere close to looking at it on a level. You hardly even hear the term today. There's hip and there's cool and there's hot and there's beauty. So there's a word to think about and contemplate on and never run out. Which arts are in the fine arts? Well, that's really open to whatever you wish. The French seemed to get it together after the individual academies that they had created under Louis XIV, with deciding to make a composite in 1795 of painting, sculpture, music, and architecture together, leaving out the favorite of Louis XIV, which was the Academy of Dance, which is his first academy, 1661. Dance can go in there, and poetry can go in there, and everything can go in there. It's a big basket that changes its name and its nature throughout time. But I think if we keep in mind that the goal is, at least in a lofty sense, beauty, and however we decide, and from beauty you can derive meaning, etc., then I think we've got a guide. It's always good to think about it. And it's good to realize that the thing I like to preach and have preached, and you preach, but boy, it's what gets me out of bed if I get a chance to preach it to anything. I'll tell my goats about it, I don't care, is that arts have mattered in Western culture. They have been the vehicle of power. They were for so long the vehicle of power and culture and cultivation and achievement and wealth and, you know, ability to do anything. And you have endless records. You can go back as far as we have dynastic records to know that the arts were a symbol of power. And, you know, until recently, until about that long ago, historically speaking. But there's all kinds of favorite examples, going back to Louis, who did so much to institutionalize and promote patronage of the arts. Louis XIV, with all that he did, and we can talk about Versailles and chandeliers, and we can talk forever about it, but the reality is the thing he cared about the most was dance. Again, his Academy of Dance, 1661, court dance as a vehicle for cultivation of diplomatic careers, that lovely term faux pas, meaning false step, does not mean for picking up the wrong fork. It means the wrong step in the middle of the beret, which if you can't do a decent beret or a gigue or allemande at court, how can you be expected to run a military campaign? If your brain can't handle the parameters of court dance for 20 straight minutes, can you command a battlefield? And the answer was no. And many a person lost status in that situation by being unable, after hours of training a day in court dance in Louis' court, to execute flawlessly the rigors of court dance. It's hugely critical in so many time periods of our culture that dance showed brain power, physical ability. Help that, well, it does in a limited way now, at least the physical ability, but it was so much more important. Moving right on, because we can get stuck in all of these, they're also interesting in the past. Frederick, well, we know he was a busy guy. What did he care most about, though? Playing the flute. He was one of the era's most important virtuosi. There's a room in his pleasure palace at Sanssouci, outside of, you know, in Potsdam, which, this is a 19th century, an 1850s Adolf Menzel romanticization of that room, but every evening possible, the focus was on chamber music. He hired Bach's most talented son, Carl Philipp Emanuel. He hired the best composers. He had silver and gold flutes. He was on the trendiest edges of the new technology that brought the flute from its vertical stage to its gorgeous, aristocratic, expensive, beautifully plated symbol of power that it was at Frederick's court. Hold a flute up to your kids and say, symbol of power, they will probably laugh. But history will tell you that you were right. And we know he was good. And the way we know he was an excellent player, by the way, is that people wrote a lot of music for him. And the music was on a high level. And you don't write music the king can't play. You know, that would be a really bad idea for your career. So it's interesting how notation in history and style can speak through the centuries. Another monarch who knew about power, she always apologized for her tin ear in music. She needed to, because that was the standard of aristocracy in the 18th century, was to be musically literate. And poor old Catherine the Great was not very good with music. She played not well, she sang not well, you know. But by golly, Ned, she could collect art. And there's no reason other than her drive that the Hermitage and those bases of the Russian museums was started. Okay, someone else might have done it, but they hadn't. And, you know, when we think of Russian culture, you know, there's all kinds of bases, but her understanding of buying up what had been deemed worthless around Europe and bringing it to the cold north put the basis on that culture that would be, without which there would be none of the things that happened in the 19th and early 20th century. So, and lest we forget, one of our own guys, you know, you don't just go across the pond to find all the examples in the past. George Washington was one of the best social dancers of his era. And if your kids don't believe you, you can do his entire biography through his involvement and interest in and following of the tunes that were trendy in social dance, that reflected the battles, that reflected the regions of the country, that reflected his friends, I get so excited when I see a book like this because I'll say just about anything. But I can say, look, look, somebody's done this. This proves that this really mattered. And so do the letters, and so do the memoirs, and so do the, and so many things are beginning to come out, especially Colonial Williamsburg and other places that are getting the art story out. They got the architecture story out. They've gotten the battles and the military stories and the economic, but the art story is just coming out now, and it's wonderful to see. Well, what happened to that tradition where the arts were at the hub and the core of dynastic power and intellectual prowess and culture and everything? Well, it stuck around a long, long time, and it went into the middle class when there finally got to be one, and it was reflected in anybody who could afford to emulate the upper class. You know, there's a reason why there are pianos in the parlors, not just because it was wonderful entertainment, but it was part of your cultured life. And I know some of us grew up with music in the home, and we grew up around a piano, and Aunt Mabel's piano, and Uncle William's, you know, ukulele, or whatever. All of that, which maybe culture tells us is just random and frill and, you know, entertainment when we get tired or, you know, we can't do any, was actually a core, a heartbeat, a system of training a little tiny child. Children came up playing all these instruments, and now we have to drive all over town and find good conservatory teachers when they used to learn it in the process of osmosis. Can we replicate that world? No. Can we bring the world back when having a beautiful painting over the sofa proved you were a cultured individual with values? No. No, we probably really can't quite do that. We've got to think about what the modern equivalent of that is. We've left from the powers of kings with the arts, and we have been influenced very much by, as was said in the session so beautifully by Susan, so many things said so beautifully, that, and since I'm a relatively frenetic person, I'm not really the perfect model to follow the contemplative stanzas that were just set, but I want to say that up front too. But at any rate, and you got to see a good, but the point being, we are in that world of Steve Reich, and we're also in the world aesthetically of American Idols. And you can make your decisions about where that all comes down. You have to. You cannot ignore it. You have to be able to bring the ability to analyze it within the historical record, which is where I think the arts are so important. But let's do a little eye test, you know, which is sharper, darker, and clearer. In our day and age, who is likely to know how to place the instruments anymore? Which was an old-fashioned exercise some of you may have grown up with, where you drew the orchestra out or you drew this riff. It really goes back. Are we more familiar with this in our world or with that? And the fact is, there's not too many little kids that can't tell you what that is. And if you think about the NCAA chart for the basketball tournament, March Madness, which is a great thing. Please understand, I watched Michael Jordan play as a freshman, okay? Which used to be a claim to fame among my students, but now they don't even kind of know who Michael Jordan is, which means you've gotten older. But the fact is, you know, this is a sophisticated thing, is it not? And when you look at that, when we look at it, we go, oh yeah, oh, this is, oh, think of all the emotion, passion, and excitement, and we think of the media and the games and the whole thing. That's huge. We're probably far more familiar with that than we are with that, which is dance choreography, which many people have never seen anymore. Sharper, darker, and clearer will be that and all that it implies to an understanding of something as simple as stage directions. One of my colleagues at SMU, where we have I'm not in that department, but I think it's a pretty spiffy department of theater. Greer Garson gave a theater. Bob Hope gave a theater. I'm not recruiting for the SMU theater department, but nonetheless, if you have charges who are looking in theater programs, don't forget that we're down there. She came in one day lamenting the fact that they'd been doing auditions for freshmen. It's very hard to get into that program. And she said, oh, you know, she was like that. And she said, do you realize we had some of our best potential? And they were reading their part, and then they read, blah, 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 blah. Mary sits down and picks up the glass of water. And they sounded very talented on their tapes. They are. But they didn't know how to read a script. Can we fix that today? It's a big charge. So where are the culprits? One culprit in the arts was the world after the Second World War. The changes in the arts that caused the arts to lift out into what you might call an elite arena for some of the right reasons and some of the wrong reasons, or at least to be perceived. Do not get me wrong. I like Jackson Pollock too. It's very important that our kids understand what happened from representational art to abstract and abstract impressionism and all of this business. They have to sort of be, and they'll like it. They'll love it. They'll want to do it. They should do it, you know? But the fact is, the experimentations and the things that happened after the Second World War in music and the arts and in literature in every form left most people breathless and confused. Something that had been the standard that one emulated and knew was treasured and precious and reinforcing kind of drifted off. And everybody was sort of left to fill the void, and they did. So that now what fills the void, as we all well know, is particularly, and this is the second culprit, not just the elitism and the changes of after the Second War, that's one, but the fact that technology became our deliverer of entertainment and no longer our own fingers and our own voices and our own hands as we sculpt and our own hands as we stitched. We can't change that either. I'm giving you all the things we can't change. But, and it's not just this thing, which many of us love, some of us don't remember bring our power cord, but we love it. Go back to the gramophone. That's where it started. If I can crank it and hear music, I don't have to learn to crank these. And from the gramophone and the player piano, both marvels of technology. Think about that. Well, you could say there's technology in music before in the arts, of course, but a pipe organ you still had to play. Cutting-edge technology, but it's still required, and those bellows boys in the back, right? Running up and down along those bellows, up and down along those bellows, so that there would be Bach. No little bellows boys, no Bach, okay? Technology has mattered to the arts, getting those flute keys figured out, and the saxophone, and all the issues of, you know, all the physical aspects of instruments, critical. But when we no longer had to know anything to get the result, it kind of did us in. That was it. It's over. We can just sit. We never have to move. You realize that? We could, our whole life, we can be completely entertained and never move. And you could say, there you go. Now, that brings up this. And it's one of the things that I deal with maybe more now that we're working with secondary school curricula, middle school and high school. And especially we go to shows, conferences, and we have a booth, you know, we have our programs, and we have Discovering Music. Just show you that quickly in passing. We'll come back to that. And I have the moms come by, and they see it, and they see music, Western arts, culture, and they go, we had trumpet lessons. Didn't work. You know how many instruments are sitting in closets these days in the back rooms? Not to mention the dance shoes, not to mention, you know, the bills for the easel for the drawing lesson, all of which is sort of tried in our culture wonderfully, beautifully. I kiss everybody who does it. But it's done in the same kind of way that I would do if I went into GNC, General Nutrition Company, and said, I'm having, you know, some issue. What do I need, you know? And some sweet salesperson will point me to the right row, and there's 43 of them, right? And I can buy one and see if it helps. You know, we have, without that basis and that connection, we are now trying to consume art as a product and hope it does something for our children. And that kind of consumption costs money, and it frequently does not work. And then it leads any good mom or dad to conclude that it becomes a frill or a luxury. And how can they conclude otherwise? You know, that trumpet cost, all right? And it proves, so what you kind of need to work with, I think, is under the idea of applied music, lessons, playing, applied art, sculpting, drawing classes, applied arts, dance, taking tap, taking ballet, taking whatever. You know, these issues, you know, buying the little architectural kits when they get a little older. That's one thing. The academic side of it, which is learning to analyze the historical record, where you begin to become aware of history and the role the arts plays in uniting that scenario. That didn't cost anything. Okay, you're doing that through one's education if it's being done. And you sort of say, ma'am, that's kind of what we're doing here with these curricula. We're trying to look back on history. And we're trying to understand history better by understanding the artistic expressions that help illuminate every aspect. And then, of course, what we really care about, I think, in classical education, what would be the most important thing, I think, is this word that gets so demeaned nowadays, appreciation. It's like beauty. It's kind of gone into the B-minus drawer. discernment will be fine. We can use a lot of words, but you say music appreciation, and what does that do for you? You know, it sounds pretty. It can even sound lame in our culture, and yet what could be more elevated than appreciation? So let's go back to some people who truly did appreciate, which is one way to tackle the problem of, or at least one way to reinforce our sense that, and I'm going to focus primarily on music, but it applies across the board, okay? And fortunately, all musicians just kiss this, you know, when they finally find out about it, which is usually quite a bit down the road. With the trivium and the quadrivium, music in the Greek sensibility was the culmination of education. I remember the first time I saw that, it was at Chapel Hill, and it was in some graduate theory seminar, and I remember looking at that and thinking, well, I'm sure Mrs. Shelton told me about it in you know, seventh and ninth and somebody else grade, but it never stuck. I remember thinking, surely they've written that wrong, you know. Could it really be that music was that important? Could it really be? It was very exciting. With the understanding that the basic training that is so much of your passion and energy every day, so that they can go through the mathematics really with the arithmetic, geometry, astronomy, and the last one would be music. But what did that mean back then? Primarily, it meant the mathematical side of music, which was a new arena. It was just as exciting to people as technology has been in our recent era. And Pythagoras is one of the guys. He's the one that gets taught all the time. And it's convenient since he kind of is well known outside of the arts for this thing and a few other things he accomplished. Actually, one of the most learned people and one of the most colorful people and really very, I think, door opening. But what, beyond all that he did in so many arenas, when he was thinking about music, he was basing it on an experience he had where he, okay, this is all legend, it probably didn't happen, and there's all kinds of reasons why it's wrong, but nonetheless, we teach it. You know, that doesn't stop a lot of things. Supposedly, he was walking down the street, and he kept hearing the anvils with the different pitches depending on the weight of the hammer and the size of the anvil, and he went, his mathematical mind went, pitch, wonder what the math for that is. And I'm sure, again, that's why you know it couldn't have happened quite that way. But it's a sweet story. And he began to create what's now called, this is not a monochord. A monochord would have one string. And experiment and find out if the chord is this long and you cut it in half, you get something that we call an octave higher. So bum, bum. And, you know, he would cut it in half and get that. And then if you cut that in half, you'll get bum, the whole string, bum, bum, bum. I don't, there it goes. Yeah. And I mean, this was big news. And what is the math for that? Well, 8, 440 on A, octave up, 880, go an octave up, 1760 vibrations per second. Again, we know all this, we learn it, but it was fantastic information. He figured out overtones. He developed different kinds of things with the water glasses that we have fun with our children now to figure out the mathematical issues of intervals. Just endless, endless stuff that was nothing new. It was in the sound of the thunder, you know, at the creation, if you wish. But the fact is, nobody done the math on it so much, at least the way he did, and set out a system that is still taught today in many, many ways. And of course, it became the basis, his theories, of medieval teaching. Pythagoras and others, Boethius being the second. Those ideas were taught and taught and taught. I love what Susan said about the scrolls. I had never thought of that, which is why we come to conferences, because there's like so many things you never thought of. And of course, when you read medieval and early Renaissance music theory treatises, you're sort of the first 85% is everything that was done in the last treatise by the last guy of the pre. And finally, and of course, if you're in a graduate class, you get smart. Speed reading means you do the last 10%, and you figure out why the guy was important. You know, this treatise is important because the last 7% of it says, everything else being that tradition handed down, reinforced. So we sit on the tradition of the Greeks with our understanding of acoustics. And I always say with children who don't take to biology or botany well, perhaps, or even, you know, give them acoustics. They'll like that. They'll like banging on things and figuring out the math, because that's up a lot of people's alleys. But acoustics and the physics of sound, for example, resting on that Greek tradition. But it was much more than that. You know, it's that whole beautiful aspect of the arts, the muses, and you know, we know how much that's still in our currency. We still think in terms of the muse descending. The muse is sometimes aromatherapy today in our minimalistic world, but we still think of this force that inspires artistic creation, poetry and painting and the muse. And that's ingrained from classical tradition, and it's actually ingrained in some very interesting ways historically. That's a huge topic, like anything in the arts. But beyond that, there was the recognition of the importance of instruments. And you may be very familiar with this, but if not, it's something that is so great because it's so much more available now. When my husband and I would be going through school, you really couldn't push a button and hear an ancient Greek instrument. You know, you would read a book about it. Now, what is more boring than that? And see a little tiny black and white picture, maybe, of a vase. And we were in the fall in Naples, outside of Naples, I'll tell you the name of the people in just a moment, and went to a research lab where they're in Stabia, which is next to Pompeii, where they're doing all kinds of excavating that never gets as famous as Pompeii, but is maybe more important because that was a two-year-old city when the volcano went boom, and it was an upper-class suburb. It was a gated community, okay? So everything there is just amazing, and they're all over it, you know, and that includes a lot of musical instruments. And from this kind of research, people now are in a position to, I mean, they've been reconstructing for a long time. The 19th century folks were all over this. But there's so much more understanding of materials and things, so that they not only can reconstruct them, but they can play them and figure out the performance practices. And it's, to be in a room, to hear somebody playing something, you know, from 200 BC, I had not had that opportunity. Blew literally me away, okay? But moving along, I wanted to share a couple things that our divisions of percussion and string and wind, they go back. The kithara, the lyre, and just to share some of the sounds that you would expect from those instruments. And again, all this is brief and just a taste. It is just that first stage. It is only not even a taste. It's a teeny drop of taste. But if you think about the beauty of these instruments, used to accompany poetry. We'll do that later. And when we hear how beautiful all it is and we can see our seventh graders just keeling over after, okay, 20 seconds of that was nice. But it's important that they know that it was a pretty rock and rolling world, and if they don't like the kithara, you know, let's give them the allos, okay? That'll do it. One mouth, two pipes. You might get 25 seconds off of that. So then what's really fun to do is have them see that there was an entire orchestra of instruments, and by golly dead, thanks to people like Sonalia, and that's their main website, by the way, and there are other groups. I just happen to be sort of excited about these people because we were blessed by the chance to interact with them. And they, by the way, kids will like this, did the sound, the historical music in Gladiator. So that ought to be worth something, right? soundcenter.it for Italy. And you make them go on and make them hit the English button and whatever. But it was a rock and rolling time. Okay, well, that's pretty wild, isn't that kind of wild? Imagine in a world that was mostly quiet, with cobblestone streets and the incredible temples and the echoing in these sounds and all the status and accomplishment and wealth that the arts represented. Well, moving right along. It's the modern world and we microtask. We talk about it with the quadrivium, but I think it's important to remember that it parallels the steps of the trivium. Now, we had the three tracks. We had the idea of the applied lesson learning of the arts, how to do the academic understanding that can only be when they're older, probably, you know, when they can't, because who knows what the past is when you're seven, you know, the past is last weekend when Granny was there, and that's it, really. And then also the appreciation which children can do at any age if we set kind of a reasonable parameter and give them the time that she was talking about earlier to explore and appreciate. And I do think with the arts, whether you're talking about dance, whether you're talking about learning to construct something of beauty, a sculpture or a painting or whatever it is, we'll just say the arts, is that okay? Oh, I went too far there, or actually, I think, yes, far, sorry, where's where I want to be. In the grammatical stage at any of these, you are learning the steps, you are learning the names, you're learning the notes, you're learning this is chalk, this is pencil, you are learning this is a rope texture, and this is what we do macro. You're learning the materials. And children can do that just as easily in the arts as they can, and maybe more easily. And this is pink, but there's not a color pink in the rainbow. We get pink by, you know. And so all of these things that are basics in art education, which Mrs. Shelton and Mrs. Clark back then in Roanoke, Virginia, they were teaching us with no resources, you know, but it didn't cost anything to teach those basics. We got that, and it enhances the grammatical development of a child. And people, by and large, accept that. They buy their kids construction paper. They get feathers and beads. With little kids, we tend to accept it, right? We say, yeah, this is important. Then when they get to the cognitive periods, we say, well, you know what we say, don't have time. Sometimes we'll let kids go through the sorting period, I like to call it, where you begin to distinguish between something old and something new, something chalk and something watercolor, something that played on a harpsichord as opposed to something played on a forte piano, where they begin to sort out sounds and images and shapes and techniques a little bit. And of course, regardless of what the art form, it's incredibly helpful to development. And again, the scientists are saying that now. I mean, they've sort of said it, but now they're proving it. Yay. You know. And then finally, the stage where almost everybody decides the arts are a frill, the rhetorical presentational stage. And the reasoning is always, well, my kids' trumpet lessons didn't go well. Well, I don't care, because we still have the academic level of understanding where they can enhance their entire academic course, whether it's physics, or whether it's history, or whether it's literature, or whether it's philosophy, by understanding the artistic dynamics of that material. And they have the appreciation level, which we keep till our last breath. So again, if we're educating for their future lives, this is not the time for the arts to go away from our children's lives. And I suspect everybody in this room fights this battle every day. So we have to keep fighting it, because there's not too many people warring on this battlefield still. So really quickly, just to leave some time, I think there's questions that are very easy, and with the little kids, and you do this anyway, but just to remind you, I think kids can respond for appreciation to build their dialectic period and to gain understanding at the grammatical period to these questions. Whether art or poetry or music or a sculpture gives them a sense of dark or light, because that defines eras. When we look at Renaissance art and the colors, or any particular period you want to pick, expressionist art, art of the 1890s, I mean, Nolde, or any of the people who were foretelling the disasters of World War I, if you will, the dark versus the light of the Rococo, of the mid-Enlightenment Mozartian world, the colors, the dark and the light always mean something. And not only that, the source of light. I think kids can sit forever and pick out where the source of light in a painting is. That's a fun game. So where's the light in this painting come from? I've never seen a child get tired of finding that, you know, because it's always different at every time period, and even in every artist, but it's always there, or you couldn't see anything, you know. And kids respond to light and shadow. Kids respond to the question of old and new, little ones. You know, now you have to remember always, the caveat is that what is still new to me, I'm still kind of adjusting to Elvis, you know, is kind of really old to them. You have to always be able to revise every few decades, and those of you who are quite young haven't had this experience yet. But as I say, when it no longer got me any points in my first class, in that first couple of classes, in the new semester at SMU, and I'd just find a way to get Michael Jordan in. I didn't care what it was, you know, because you want to be sort of hip or have something. And then when they're looking at me and someone says, "Who's Michael Jordan?" I know it's time to reevaluate old and new, and old and new will flip on you 2 to 3 times in a lifetime. It's great fun, and it's worth thinking about, but generally speaking, we can do a lot of understanding history through the arts with old and new. Kids can't talk to you about Gothic architecture, but they do see that this is old and under and involved a different skill set and a different set of societal, cultural, and historical values, not to mention materials. Where'd they get this stuff back then with the carts and the, you know, littlest ones? Can you imagine how many donkey carts it took to get that stone? Let's pick up a stone. I mean, you can go anywhere you want with it. To understanding how the architecture of an area right now, very threatened by disaster, that this is new, and why, and what does this bespeak of our times and our culture, and on, endless with architecture, endless with dance. Kids can figure out that that's kind of probably an older bunch of folks than this, and that's probably maybe a hipper version, and you can help them figure it out so they can understand. It's better if they can see it dance. It's better if they see a video. It's okay to see stills. It's okay to try it. Again, old and new, it's a part of a discernment. It's part of judgment that I think is very helpful for children to begin to sort out, gather impressions at a grammatical stage, and sort out as they become a little more proficient. And then there's always old and new this way. Let me just share this one pretty quickly. We have the keyboard. Yeah, well, again, we have your harpsichord inside with all its beautiful decorations, light enough that two of us can pick it up and cart it around, as opposed to the modern forte piano. But by golly, Ned, what's all that stuff doing in there? Looks like I spilled my purse in the piano. And actually, that's not a bad way to go about what we're about to do. Reminding children of the sound of a harpsichord, of course, which we had playing a few minutes ago. A sound that is both old, but incredibly vital when they learn about those little pluckers and they learn how it was built and the delicate wood and the incredible, okay. It's a sound of an upper class world, the sound of court life, sound of a world of clarity, if you will. And it does have cadences, so that's nice, to this world. John Cage, Sonatas and Interludes, 1954. Nobody had a synthesizer yet. You better believe that caught people's attention. Why did he do it? Practical reasons. He created what we call the prepared piano because one of his friends was a dance choreographer, had a little company, had a tiny theater, had no budget for musicians, and wanted something interesting for them to dance to. And John Cage, being a young, at that time, absolutely wild, absolutely one of the craziest, most challenging artists, and yet incredibly fun. If you stay away from a few topics, and stay away from the magic mushroom part, okay, but you stay away from all that. But the fact is, and you always have to censor the arts, we do know that, right? Which is the problem with using biography. That's a different talk. I love biography. I love the great masters. I like all that. But there's all kinds of issues, and it doesn't always give you the target on the art itself, or gives you the wrong path to the target, I would argue in some cases. Different talk. But so Cage got a bunch of nuts and bolts and rubber things and put them in the piano and messed around with them and created the prepared piano. And you could argue that an awful lot of what happened in the arts from the 1950s on was in John Cage's whimsical, practical, utilitarian move to create something that would indeed give you a very hip sound for those dancers doing not, you know, jetés, but an entire type of choreography that was already well under the way in modern dance. Thank you, Mr. Cage. So, moving very, okay. Question 3. Kids respond to form. And you can teach form in all kinds of ways. You can start with what's in the kitchen. What's a cup? Everybody knows what a cup is. Or do we? What's Catherine the Great's mug looked like, as opposed to the mugs from prehistory? You know, I mean, just the very fact that our functional arts are utilitarian arts that were spoken about in the fine arts theories of the 18th century also have beauty, and they have function and form. You know, and where does function and form and beauty and appreciation all, you know, you keep stirring that stew, keep stirring that stew. They're not meant to be on separate plates with the little divisions that keep our food separate. You know, they're meant to flow together. That was part of appreciation. Fashion's one of the greatest ways to teach history. Now are we talking fashion, climate, wealth, silliness, you know, men's neckwear is, you can pretty much do Western culture, I think, by men's neckwear up to this point. Women, you have to kind of go around looking at the show. I mean, women weren't the showbirds. That's not historically correct, you know. They were when they were brought out, maybe. But here's where the energy was, and here's where the dynamism was. And you can go and go and go with that. Form that way. Form in a way we would particularly expect to find it in visual art, in architecture, and certainly in music. And dance, oh, what about that kind of form? Well, there's form, there's music, there's dance. There's a modern version. You could not have done any of this. And it's fun for kids, they look at this, they say, oh, that's weird. Could they have done it in the 19th century? I don't think we had those kind of swimming pools. We wouldn't have had underwater photography. Where do you want to start? And that's part of that old and new. And it doesn't, in a way, in my view, really matter where all this leads. It's that they ask the questions and that they respond to form in different media and in different environments that tickle them for about, again, 9 seconds, but 9 seconds long when you're little, you know? And of course, in the obvious issue of form and music, both on the page and how we learn to hear it, which is again another type of endeavor. But kids can hear form in music because they can hear repetition and contrast. So they can hear da 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 dum ba da da dum ba da 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 dum ba da 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 dum, and then they hear that it repeats da 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 dum ba da da dum ba da 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 dum ba da 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 dum. Got two of those. Da 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 ba da da dum. Got a very different thing here, and it is in contrast. Oh, ba da da dum ba da da dum. We are back where we started. Da 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 da. Little different at the end, but they won't hear that. And they hear form. And kids can hear form. They don't have to name it. They don't have to care about it. But they can hear it. They can hear it. Or they can hear the absence of it. So that's kind of good for the ear. One last thing. Message. Which ultimately is where we are when we get to that third stage of appreciation. And message depends on culture, and culture depends on chronology, if you wish. So I'm sure many of us remember seeing that for the first time, and or at least and wondering why it was art, or was it really just tomato soup? And we could go forever on the issue of message and where it leads and what any culture does with message. You know, again, there's not an end goal there. It's the questioning. It's the participation of the child, who will have wacky and wonderful and absolutely correct ideas on these things. And then it's really important, I think, to say to them, don't think you know the artist just because of, you know, the Marilyn Monroe or whatever it is. Because if you really look at Andy Warhol's life, which is probably not what you put in the hands of a fourth grader, okay, but the fact was he was a devout man, almost never missed daily mass. There's a surprise. It's not how the media portrays him, right? And at the end of his life was working on a series of sketches very seriously for a large painting of the Last Supper. That's not the tomato can guy in my mind. Sometimes biography illuminates in ways that are very inspirational. So, we're a little bit out of time because I did have my little core problem. However, it's very, let me give one more quick example. It's very easy, we're okay for a second. It's very easy to look at historical arts. Kids like to do it. They'll learn Louis, they'll learn Versailles, they'll learn about the wonderful dressages and the carousels where the, you know, the wonderful dance of horses, which symbolize power, and then the court dance, which would symbolize power, and they can make their popsicle stick versions of the Hall of Mirrors. I don't care. You know, all of that is so valuable at the young ages. Did you guys make a popsicle stick fort of Jamestown when you grew up? Was it just my, anybody else do that? Oh, thank you. See, I mean, I still remember making that fort and being astonished that mine was, it stood up. And I think sometimes these little things, you know, painting a picture or creating an instrument out of, for example, I won't start down this path, but catch me later tonight. I'll talk to you about the turkey baster and being able to play the a Rossini overture on a turkey baster. It can be done. It is done. But, you know, finding out that acoustics and music and sound exist in the kitchen drawer, on and on. But at any rate, you've got all this historical. You've got lots of payback when you look at history through the lens of the arts. Absolutely. But I think it's also critical to show them that that which is one form socially can transform in meaning and message. So graffiti, boo, hiss, graffiti, right? Well, Bauhaus University offers graduate degrees in graffiti now, and so do many other European and I suspect American universities as well. Graffiti, which started, I think many of us remember, has become a very esteemed art form, and if we'd say, I don't want to make that leap, we can look at this with the Berlin Wall, another thing that's fading from people's memories, but not everybody's, where the West Side was nothing but a string of miles and miles of graffiti as a symbol of freedom and mobility and hope and light and color. And I can pretty much promise you there was no graffiti over here on the East Side, okay, with the Death Strip in between. So now are we talking about graffiti? Are we talking about art? Are we talking about politics? What are we talking about here? All of it, that stew. And then you get to the point where nowadays, when those tablets were dismantled and some were kept and put in outdoor parks as items of art that the little kids now can go see and go, Mommy, what's that? You can't explain it, but you can see it. And in a way, when we get it to the art form, and I mean, that is really the message. When we see it in a frame or hear it on a stage today, that which was really intended to be performed in the salon of the king or in the saloon of the craftsman, and we hear it on stage, I love it, I love it, I love it. But the reality is it was not intended generally for a stage. It was part of the interweaving of daily life. And we have got to, I think, where possible, put value on any effort we make to help kids do that through the trivium, through the steps of understanding, possibly for the few that have that talent or whose families can afford it or are really good, the applied stage, the academic stage for enlightenment academically, but most importantly, the appreciation, the end goal of beauty, which is compatible completely with the end goals of a classical education. So that is what I had to share, and I thank you very much. I'd be happy to take some questions or comments or experiences. Yes, sir.
I guess the fine art that whose state puzzles me the most right now is probably dance.
Yeah?
The way I see it, you have dance being associated with aristocracy and with an elitism, right? It's a path to a certain kind of elite success. And it's also a part of common life, right?
Yes. Dancing, yes, absolutely.
And then you have, you know, religious ritual for dancing, or
yes,
the religious ritual is to not dance or do anything come close to dancing. But today it seems like there's so little space for dance to be like a common thing that's held together. Either it continues to be something that's pushed into further and further elite corners, either in the way athleticism is now prized in a lot of forms of dance in a totally unique way, or the form is extremely esoteric, or our common forms of dance are they're kind of non-existent to speak of. And some of that seems to be because of the democratization and the way capitalistic culture, consumer culture, has changed things. And some of it might be, you know, corresponding to, you know, other changes in norms. But I guess my question is, what accounts for the way that dance has just sort of kind of gone to all these peripheral edges, especially whenever, which is strange because it seems to be the artistic form that seems to combine so many things, right? You're involved with music and you're physically using your body,
yes,
and you're engaged in community, you're doing all these other things, and all those things seem to be completely absent in art, you know, in where dance is today. So I guess just your thoughts on why dance is the way it is and steps to maybe look to recover that, because, you know, whenever I think about that, it seems like my only options are to get really good at specialized form or to go to one of those, not to cause any offense, but kind of one of those cultic groups like the contra dance people or the English country dance people. Or, you know, whether it's
yeah,
associated with yeah, a very, very
yeah, 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 specific historical subculture that's very dedicated.
You go to, you know, a music yeah, concert where, you know, it's meant to be danceable, people don't dance anymore.
No,
right?
No. No.
Everybody stands in the middle. So
I think you've just identified your new life's mission, for one thing, because you're completely right about I at least I would agree with nearly everything, and I'm no dance historian or dance critic, but, you know, I tell you, it was said the best. I think it was Fred Astaire who said it. We don't need dance anymore in our interactions, male-female. It used to be that it was the one place where men and women could get within 6 feet of each other, the other one being playing music together. Why do you think duets were so important? You're on a bench next to someone that you're pretty excited about. And you're allowed to sit touching. Why do you think all that hand crossing went on? There's even instructions in Wilhelm Friedemann Bach's Sixth Hand where the lady sits in the middle and her two suitors are on either side as they play the six-hand piece. And there are clear instructions that the men must cross over her arms, because you think about what would happen if they went under. You got that would not be good. But it was Fred Astaire who said, if I'm not mistaken, you don't need dance anymore. All you've got to say is, your place or mine. Dance was courtship. Dance was sexuality expressed in, you know, dance was encouraged and cultivated and organized so that kids could touch, for one thing, or at least get close to touching and whisper where they were going to meet at midnight unbeknownst to the parents. I mean, it's a very sultry form. The sultriness has carried over. The necessity of it socially is gone. And I would say one more thing about dance. 50,000 things, but one thing. You know, people say, I hear this a lot. I don't like breakdance. Oh, it's terrible. I defy that person to sit on the streets of whatever metropolitan area. Try to focus on these kids who are, what, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, doing utterly amazing, as you said, athletic things, and not be astonished. But it's become a solo event. So much of it is solo now. Does that gel with what we know of our culture? And then you could sort of say, if it's 100 years from now and you're going to show a picture of breakdancing and not include fashion, politics, economics, you know, everything that would be in the news, everything that's in the technology, can you understand it? Same with rap. So I think those are some things that have changed. We don't need to hold hands that way anymore or rub against one another anymore through dance. And we become individual. And I don't know if we recover from it. But we can try, because you're going to lead the way. Maybe.
You haven't seen me try to dance, so.
Not yet, but the conference is young. The conference is young. Is that... Yes?
I do see a form of dance, which is a group experience, and it's primarily the girls, and they have these choreographed group dances that they love, you know, to pop music.
Yeah.
I don't know how they learn this, but they do, and they want to be in a group, and then your nightclub is a group formless expression or reaction to music, but it is formless, and it is a group experience. It's a lot different. I think it's just the modern expression of our life that is formless, and it's intense, and the music's so loud you can't talk or interact in any way, and it's just a visceral, formless thing.
Formless to us,
out of our society. And I haven't hung around that crowd in a while, but I do see exercise.
Oh, a Zumba.
Zumba. Yeah. I feel like I'm in a nightclub in college doing Zumba, but it's this group energy that feeds off each other, and it's the loud music that sort of feeds the soul in a spiritual way.
Yeah. And line dancing but you know, line dancing, because it's, you don't need to know how to do anything.
That's what I was going to say. It's, I think it's also interesting when you put up kind of that Elvis, the old and new. You know, I was trying to teach, I have a CD from the Disney Channel or whatever, and it's interesting to see, you know, students that don't even know the YMCA anymore. I mean, like, the students were like, what is that, you know? I mean, they don't even know the YMCA, so sometimes...
Oh, you mean the song, or do you mean
the actual
building?
The actual song,
yeah.
You know.
Can we all do it?
Twist, you know, all of that, and so... In a way, I haven't even tackled some of, like, going all the way back to that kind of art as a form, as opposed to just, as you said, kind of your old and new changes through a lifetime. And, you know, considering my age, I was like, that just seemed very weird to me that they did learn that. So part of my curriculum, or some of the things that I do as kind of a breakout, is doing things like the Macarena and the cha-cha slide, which does force them to listen to directions. Mm-hmm. So, and the YMCA and the twist and shout, and especially the younger they are, it was interesting, my 4 and 5 year olds, to watch the mechanics, their motor skills, as they got better with the cha-cha slide and things like that. Being able to flip their hands over and cross them and follow a series of directions. So.
Yes.
Why do you think that in the quadrivium they left out dance or drama? Was there not as much math concepts?
That's my understanding, and you know, having not.
Is there math concepts in dance?
Every good dancer would tell you that, and more physics and balance. And you know, when you really look at people designing choreography, it doesn't look like anything other than geometry. It's pure geometry.
Comparatively, it's not as much as music, so it's focused on music.
Well, so much of it was temple dance. And you didn't, and that's one thing, Sonalia. There is, if you go to YouTube, there's not a lot. And watch out, there's an Italian rock group called Sonalia, and the stuff's okay. So they're all, they have clothes on and everything. But nonetheless, yeah, don't, just, but they, if you Google Hermitage, the Hermitage in St. Peter, or St. Petersburg, and or Russia and Sonalia, you'll come up with this very bad quality video of an exhibit they did when they brought the frescoes from Stabia a number of years ago to the Hermitage for an exhibit. And they come through the halls with the big horns and the, and they do the dance, you know, and of course there's a lot of groups doing this, but it was all worshipful, it was to the gods, it was, and those things don't tend to get dissected the same way. They were, they're taught, dance, I think the other thing, and you're saying it, you're doing it right now, is absolute mentored. It's one-on-one. You can't read a book and learn to dance. Somebody's got to grab your arm and push your foot out, you know, and straighten your back, and that's the only, and hurt you, basically, to learn to dance. And that's one of the hard things. Teaching dance nowadays in places where you're not supposed to touch kids. Cello, how do you teach cello if you can't touch a kid's hand? I'm sorry. You got to go, wah, you know. And so that's what, the arts are physical. They're so physical, and that's, we're in a funny place with that, but does that help at all, I think? But there are probably much better answers to that, but that's the one that came to mind. I guess we need to, oh, I'm sorry. Thank you all so very much. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.